The future of Iraq is on the line today, Thursday, June 19th. It's a special edition of The World and the Takeaway from PRI. I'm Marco Werman with The World.
And I'm John Hockenberry with The Takeaway. Is this ancient country falling apart? The sense on the ground is that the very concept of Iraqi nationhood may be slipping away.
Most people who I talk to here say that, you know, Iraq, as we know it as a single unified country, is a thing of the past. It just doesn't exist anymore.
Over the next hour, we'll hear how the crisis in Iraq is impacting Iraqis, the region, and the United States.
American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq. But we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well.
Iraq and its future after the news. I'm Marco Werman in Boston, and this is The World from PRI. We're joining forces today with our colleagues at The Takeaway to unpack the crisis in Iraq, a crisis that threatens the very unity of the country. My partner throughout this hour is The Takeaway's John Hockenberry. He's in New York. John, welcome.
Great to be with you, Marco.
I got to say, it's really useful to merge our two newsrooms today to discuss the crisis in Iraq. I mean, it's a story with major implications, global and domestic. Huge implications, obviously, for Iraqis who are caught in the crossfire, but also for the wider Mideast, including neighboring Syria, where there's another war out of control, and for us Americans, including so many of our veterans who fought there. Now wondering, of course, what the blood and treasure was all about if Iraq is now falling apart 3 years after U.S. troops pulled out. John, The Takeaway has been covering the news out of Iraq, I know, but also the domestic conversation around it, right?
And they go together, Marco, with voices from Iraq and from America's main streets. We've been hearing the fears of Iraqis about the future of their own country, but we've also been hearing the heartbreak and frustration about what seems to have been the failure of an 11-year mission to give Iraq a stable political option going forward.
We're going to hear your interview for a little more insight into that with the Iraqi ambassador in Washington. But first, the world's listeners have asked us a lot of questions about all of the above, and we've been answering some of them over the past few days. What are you hearing from Takeaway listeners, John?
Well, there's an intense, passionate conversation going on in America that has brought out deep skepticism among some citizens about the Iraq invasion, perhaps a skepticism that preceded the Iraq invasion, but also an impatience that the White House will perhaps do too little and end up, in their view, wasting the lives and efforts of the past 11 years.
Hi, my name is Mark. I'm calling from Orlando, Florida. I'm an Iraq war veteran. I deployed there twice. And after being away from the region, I think that the first invasion was a mistake. And to go back is just going to waste more lives in a conflict that I don't think that we have any reason or purpose in being involved with.
This is Ray from Newark, Delaware. I think it would be terrible if the weaponry we left continued to kill the innocents. It's our responsibility to clean up our mess.
This is Michael from San Antonio, Texas. I believe that at a minimum, we should leave the same level of stability present before we invaded in 2003. Shame on us for forsaking those whose lives we upended 11 years ago.
Mixed but very passionate feelings among some of the listeners we've been hearing from this last week. Very mixed feelings. But what about the role of the United States? What should it be at this stage? I think you can also hear the real frustration that there are no really good options as well, Marco.
Yeah. So don't send U.S. troops. Clean up the mess. The U.S. is responsible and should pick up its responsibility. I mean, interesting stuff. And it felt like those were things President Obama seemed sensitive to today when he was talking about Iraq. Very similar stuff, too, to what we've been hearing from the world's listeners, including this from listener Merrill Webb, who begins by saying, typical American question, so why can't we just let the whole region burn? Please tell us why that would be bad for us. So clearly someone who doesn't want the U.S. to get involved at all. We got a message on Facebook from Reza Motasher, who writes, I am Iraqi, and I've always wondered how a proud people that never paid attention to sect all of a sudden did. We always were Iraqi first. Now we say Sunni, Shia, how and why? And that is a question we've heard from a lot of people. We've been asking a number of Iraqis in our coverage about how they perceive the Sunni-Shia split, and we've also got writer Azadeh Moveni later in the program to deal with that question head-on. Listener Colin Finikane wrote on Twitter, this is not the end of Iraq. This is the beginning of the powers that be in the Middle East taking responsibility. So, John, let's start with that and chewing some on some of the big questions generated by this crisis. You spoke with Iraq's ambassador to the U.S.,
Well, it's surprising and really quite striking how frustrating Iraqis express this sectarian divide that so many people describe as almost like the part of the geography of Iraq. They don't necessarily view that as the destiny of Iraq. Ambassador Luqman Faili is a diplomat in a very tough position today. We reached him this afternoon. He insisted he's still in touch with his foreign minister in Baghdad, that the government still claims territorial sovereignty over all of Iraq, despite the reports. He admitted that there have been military setbacks. He called the situation an emergency and pleaded for U.S. help in stopping the group ISIS from igniting what he literally told us could become a global religious war.
We are hearing a lot of positive signs from the White House regarding their engagement, their support, their comprehensive package, and so on. What we're saying is that we have an immediate threat. Security and making sure that ISIL is defeated is the main target, should be the main target now.
How do you explain the reports out of Mosul that so many soldiers, Iraqi government soldiers, abandoned their weapons and uniforms and simply ran away when faced with engagement by ISIS and ISIL?
There's a lot of lessons to learn there. There's a serious reflection going on. There has been some change at the leadership within the military. More will follow. These are all areas we are looking at. However, what we're saying now is we have an immediate threat regarding the integrity of Iraq and regarding an international terrorist organization which pose a threat to the region. That's where I think the seriousness and the debate should be.
Well, I think that I'm sensitive to your sense of an emergency here, but the fact that you have an army that runs in the face of that threat would seem to contribute to the emergency, not be an ancillary or fringe issue.
That's exactly what we're saying when we talk about United States providing us with training, with capabilities. That's exactly what we're talking about. We're saying we have asked for United States for help. We have a strategic framework which talks about the integrity and security of Iraq and therefore the integrity and security of the region. The issue is vital to U.S. interest, not just vital to us, it's existential to our presence or to our existence, actually.
Although, with all due respect, Ambassador, the question of soldiers running in the face of engagement is not a matter of training. That seems to be a fairly basic issue. If they can't stand and fight and they have nothing to fight for, U.S. training isn't going to help you there.
I agree with you, John. There was an issue of morale. However, that issue is not the main issue now, because areas which we have engaged with ISIL and others, we have proven now that that issue has been addressed. People are mobilized because of the government refocus and more so because of the threat to their existence. We cannot coexist with ISIL. What we have there, part of it is internal, most of it is regional. And we know that ISIL is not an entity we can live with. We cannot have them as a next-door neighbor. That's the issue we have. Grand Ayatollah Sistani made a fatwa that has a significant morale booster. So in a way, I think the issue of what took place in Mosul is an area we're looking at, but the issue of morale is no longer the key question.
But isn't the fatwa from Cleric Sistani of most relevance to Shiites in Iraq? Doesn't that, in a sense, inflame the sectarian problems here?
No. What he's saying is that defend your land, work with the government. These are all national statements, nothing about sectarianism. On the contrary, we have Sunnis who have volunteered, as well as others who have said that this is the right national message. So, on the contrary, he over the last 10 years, Grand Ayatollah Sistani has proven again and again that he is after the unity and the coexistence of the Iraqi communities, and he's anti anything to do with terrorism. So, certainly not.
People all week long have been telling us, and even last week, that this is the beginning of the end of Iraq as we know it. This is the partition of Iraq into an independent Kurdistan, a Sunni belt around Baghdad, and some sort of southern district that would involve Basra. What do you say to that?
We're saying that ISIL people can't coexist with, and they are determined to get rid of them outside, kick them out of the country. To do that, we need help. The threat, if we don't get help, it would be a prolonged, vicious war with in this street fighting, others with ISIL. We don't want that. Then surely United States don't want that. Any help and support in counterterrorism, air supremacy and others will greatly help us. We, as a democratic society, help us in our fight against international terrorism.
Ambassador Faley, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you.
So that was Iraq's ambassador to the United States, Luqman Faley. He spoke to me from Washington, D.C. And we should remind people, he uses the acronym ISIL, which means an Islamic State in Syria and Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. It also is ISIL, Iraqi Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, which is also a synonym for Syria. So that confusion that even President Obama helps contribute to, ISIL, ISIS, they both refer to the same group. One thing, Marco, that I want to tell you about the ambassador, he is a Kurd, but he is a Shiite, which is unusual. Most Kurds are Sunni. And so he very keenly feels this sense of a sectarian divide and also a sense that the Iraqis have proved that they can live together.
You pressed him pretty hard there, John, I got to say, and he still did not have a convincing answer on why Iraqi troops melted away when facing those militants from ISIS, ISIL, and Mosul. I mean, several experts we've spoken to on The World say that's because of the mission of the Iraqi army. They're in it for the money, not to protect their country. I don't know if you've heard that.
Well, I've definitely heard that. I've also heard that we've spent $12 billion on that training, and to have them disappear at the first sign of an offensive in Mosul is a very, very frustrating sign, and it's hard to imagine how 300 special forces from the U.S. is going to turn that around.
You wonder if they're encouraged by that news today from President Obama in Baghdad, or whether it's just too little too late.
It seems to me the headline from Obama today is leaders cannot lead unless they rise above the sectarian divides. That, I think, is the key phrase. And whether that means Nouri al-Maliki is out or someone like Nouri al-Maliki has to come in and basically do something to rise above the sectarian tension, I think that's the drama over the next several days.
All right. Well, more ahead on Iraq. He's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. I'm Marco Werman with PRI's The World. We've joined newsrooms to focus on Iraq this hour. And just before we take a short break, John, let me take you and our listeners musically back to 2003, February, less than a month before the U.S. invasion, in shock and awe. And a singer from Iraq, the country's biggest star, a man named Kazem El-Saher, he's about to play for the first time in Las Vegas at the Palms Resort and Casino. His visa applications had previously been rejected, but for some reason, on the eve of the Iraq War, he got in. Kazem El-Saher, this is a guy who has sold tens of millions of records in the Arab world. Let's just hear one song he wrote called Baghdad. It may be a city riddled with anxiety and fear right now, but Kazem El-Saher's song shows just what enormous affection Iraqis have for this historic city. This is The World and The Takeaway on PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway, continuing with our special hour on the unfolding crisis in Iraq with our friends at The World. I'm here with Marco Werman. And Marco, let's turn back to Baghdad so evocatively thought of from that music that you gave us just before the break, specifically where tensions and fears in the capital city of Iraq are clearly rising.
Yeah, I'll say, John, we've been trying all week to reach our friend and colleague Sahar Issa in Baghdad, and it's been really frustrating. The phone line keeps going down. Experience, I'm sure you're finding at the Takeaway, trying to get through to pretty much anywhere in Iraq the last few days. But we got through briefly today and found out there'd been a firefight right outside her house. Sahar Issa says a bullet went through into a bedroom.
It's terrifying. Very many Baghdadi families are leaving. If they can't afford to leave, or if they have elderly people with them, at least they are asking the young people to leave. It is very frightening.
Yeah, Sahar also told us that heavily armed Shiite militia are parading. Parading is the word she used, in Sunni neighborhoods. And Sahar is worried that someone might come and break down her front door to come after her own family.
Now, again, as we saw in 2007, when you look into faces, you see question mark in the face. Are you hostile or are you a friendly? Even the people are beginning again to be afraid of each other.
Yeah, that's incredible. My hair on my arms just stood up. I don't know if you just, I mean, the whole idea that she's looking into people's eyes on the street and asking herself, are you hostile? Are you friendly? I mean, can you imagine that on the streets of New York?
No, but it sounds very much like what happened in the Balkans, where it was friendly versus unfriendly in that very, very, you know, close, dense neighborhood where people who didn't really think about religion suddenly were thinking about what their identities were. And the surge of violence and uncertainty in Iraq has been especially painful to witness for American veterans of the war there who also roamed the streets of Baghdad. For instance, former U.S. Army Captain Blake Hall, who fought throughout Iraq during those worst months of 2007, Blake remembers the spiral of violence then, and he worries for Iraqis caught in something similar today.
I just think it's incredibly unfortunate because the average Iraqi family is going to be caught in the middle of all of these forces. And when I think about a neighborhood like Dora, which is Sunni and right in the middle of Baghdad, as these militants come closer, those folks are at pretty high risk for, you know, for being targeted as part of a, you know, a genocide type of campaign. So it's tough.
Army veteran Blake Hall is watching Iraq from Washington. And there are lots of Iraqis here in the U.S., too, who are watching these tragic events unfolding back home. Earlier today, I spoke with Sarah Darwish. She's a young Iraqi doctor living near San Diego. She and her family are refugees, still adjusting to their new life here in the U.S.
Well, it's really painful to be away and sitting away from home and watching all those news on TV and watching like people suffering there. So it's harder than being on spot, actually, like before.
Harder to be thousands of miles away than it is to actually
yeah.
be there. I mean, are you finding yourself constantly checking in with the news, or are you trying to?
Sure, it's like obsession, like checking the TV all the time. The TV is on Iraqi channels, and it's installed many of the apps on the phone to just be updated with the news. Find it hard to concentrate.
So you are speaking with friends and family back home, or what are they telling you?
But it's getting difficult because the communication disconnected internet media, so it's not that easy to be in touch with them, but still lucky to hear from them like every day and another.
And I assume some of them live in Baghdad. What are they saying? Because we've heard that ISIS forces are now pretty close to Baghdad.
Oh, they are saying that people are very anxious and cautious. They're actually taking the measures for, like, preparing for if they cannot go out of home, like storing food and medication. And it's very frustrating, actually.
Are you in touch with Iraqis who live here in the United States, and are you speaking with them?
Yeah. Mostly, actually, it's about how sorry we feel for our families and friends who feels like they are trapped there, you know, because when we got here and start comparing and see how comfortable life here, we really feel sorry for people there, especially when days like those when the situation is very bad.
Feeling bad that you kind of got the break and they did not.
Exactly.
What about going back to Iraq someday? I mean, if you're studying medicine, I imagine that's something you might want to actually practice in Iraq. How are you feeling now about that?
I really would love to and hope to go back there someday. But when it's a messy situation like this, I mean, it's not really easy. It may be possible like to go for a visit or something, but living there is just difficult.
I was really struck, Sarah, by what you said about life being so hard, so many thousands of miles away from Iraq, harder than it would be if you were in Iraq. I mean, do you feel like there's nothing you can do to help?
For the time being, I don't know if there's anything that we can contribute to except like praying for them, because it's much more complicated than what people can do. It's like something, it's governmental or something higher like this, so. I don't know if there is something we can do for them.
What are you able to tell your family, your friends back in Iraq when you get them on the phone? Is there have you found words to give them kind of some support?
I would say that we're strong people and we've made it through many harder times. So it's just one of those hard times and hopefully things will get better.
Sarah Darwish, thanks very much for your thoughts. Really appreciate it. Stay strong.
Thank you so much.
Sarah says it all. Their home is home in the hearts of people from Iraq, but they carry this pain and this sense of longing with them. And the Iraq that they see through television, through news reports, through social media, through all the ways in which they can follow what's happening in Iraq, they find it unrecognizable. And that tension, as Sarah suggests there, actually increases the stress of being away, the sense that if it's interrupted for just a moment, the phone call, the internet connection, that the worst could have happened. It's amazing.
Yeah, she's not like sure what she can actually do to help out. And yet she comes up with this kind of notion that Iraqis were a strong people. We will get through this. And that kind of embedded in that, there's almost a defiance when you think about get through this and what that means. I mean, Iraq has managed to get through a lot, but at such an extraordinary price. You combine that with her sense of helplessness in San Diego, thousands of miles from home. There's that painful survivor guilt. It's just crushing.
And think of the time. I mean, this has been 11 years since the 2003 invasion. I mean, young people have grown up during this time. There are people who have only known this situation of exile and total chaos in Iraq, who've only known an absolutely uncertain future in Iraq. And so to see this happening again, it's just extraordinary.
You know, I was reminded in recent days, as we've been looking for Iraqis who fled the fighting and resettled here. I profiled a family a couple of years ago in Phoenix. They spent years in transit out of Iraq. The mother was a translator for the Americans during the occupation. Got too dicey, so they left. But when I asked her this week if she'd speak with us, she said she'd have to consult her family, kind of an implication that things are so tense there in Iraq that speaking might lead to reprisals for her family back home. Really terrible situation.
Yeah, there's nothing over here. It's it may be over for some people in the United States, but it's not over by a long shot.
Much more still to come on this special edition of The World and the Takeaway focused on Iraq. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman.
I'm John Hockenberry.
Ahead, we continue our exploration of Iraq and its future as the country threatens to break up along sectarian lines.
We'll hear where the Sunni-Shia split originated, plus the view from Kurdistan, Baghdad, and Washington.
It's all ahead on this special Iraq edition of The World and the Takeaway from PRI. I'm Marco Werman with PRI's The World.
And I'm John Hockenberry with The Takeaway. We're focusing this hour, of course, on the unfolding crisis and the global implications of the crisis in Iraq.
And John, one of the things we keep hearing is that Iraq as we know it, a united country with Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds, is at risk of falling apart. Maybe already is. You spoke with Global Post reporter Susanna George about this today. She's in Erbil in northern Iraq. What did she tell you?
Well, she didn't use the word united very much, that's for sure. Susanna is in a dangerous no-man's land in north-central Iraq. Erbil, the city of Erbil, is under solid Kurdish control, but on the roads out of Erbil, she can get very close to the unstable and impenetrable approaches to the ISIS-held city of Mosul. And here is her account of the feeling of people fleeing for their lives.
I mean, I definitely say that the overwhelming feeling here is hopelessness. I think people are tired. And most people who I talk to here say that, you know, Iraq, as we know it as a single unified country, is a thing of the past. It just doesn't exist anymore. Especially in the Kurdish region, you're hearing for a lot of calls for Iraq to divide into three parts, a Sunni, a Shia, and a Kurdish part.
You know, one of the most remarkable quotes I heard this week was that the reason the Iraqi fighters, the Iraqi government and security forces put down their weapons and tore off their uniforms and left Mosul is because they felt they had nothing to fight for. Is that a commentary on the government of Nouri al-Maliki at this point? And is that a widely shared belief?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's a combination of a lot of different things. I think that there's a lot of disillusionment with Maliki as a leader, with his government, which a lot of Sunnis see as increasingly sectarian, a government that oppresses them. And then I think that also you do have a sense that people are not fighting for a single nation. They're not fighting for a homeland. That's one of the reasons when you talk to Kurds that they say their Peshmerga forces are so effective, because they actually have a real strong idea of a homeland that they're fighting to protect.
And that is not the case for the Sunnis, even though they generally describe their territory as being around Baghdad. And the Shia militias, at least, claim the south of the country. That's much less clear at this point, right?
Yes, though, interestingly, we did see a shift of a kind after we heard a call to arms by Shia leader Ayatollah Ali Sistani. After that call to arms, a lot of the Shia soldiers who I spoke to who deserted said that they now felt that they really had to get back out onto the battlefield. Now they actually had something to fight for because it became a religious duty for them. No longer, they weren't just fighting for their country, they were fighting for their religion.
Which also underscores the point that the government is not really involved here. It's become a sectarian battle, and the government has really been pushed aside. Let's hear from a woman who only wanted to be identified by her first name, Rhonda, someone you talked to who actually fled Baghdad because it's too tense in Baghdad, and you caught up with her near Erbil. Rhonda here.
You can say I hate them all. So I don't know. I don't know all of them. I don't care of them, actually.
She expressed what you hear a lot here in Iraq, that no one really feels like they have a leader that represents them, and people just have a complete lack of faith in this entire order that was installed after the 2003 invasion.
And there's not much faith in the United States. Here's Rhonda one more time.
I think Iraqi people need to solve that problem, not just the U.S. politicals, you know. Let's need to Iraqi politicals to solve this problem, because it's an Iraqi matter, you know. That's not a Sudanese international matter.
It's an Iraqi matter, she says. It's not an international matter. That sounds to me like a prescription, though, for chaos in the near term, and that may even become long term, depending on what you're seeing on the ground there, Susanna.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you're definitely hearing a combination of, you know, frustration with the United States and with foreign intervention, not only from the U.S., but also from Iran. But at the same time, a complete lack of faith in the other options, the Iraqi options that are available to people, their government and their military, the institutions that are supposed to be protecting Iraq.
Anybody missing the days of Saddam Hussein? And does anyone have faith that Iran might actually be able to help at least the population in the south of the country?
I think that, you know, people are increasingly desperate. You do hear from some Iraqis that they just want someone to kind of step in and bring things under control. But it's hard to generalize with that. People, I think, are frustrated and tired, and they're just kind of looking for an end to the conflict.
Do they think that Iran is capable of ending this conflict? Is there any trust in the government of Iran, which, of course, has more power now than it's had in decades in the region?
Trust is not something that I'm hearing or picking up from people. I think after this kind of fantastic collapse of the Iraqi military in the north of the country, some people feel that if these al-Qaeda-inspired militants are going to be contained, pushed back from the capital, that someone is going to need to step in.
Susanna George, thank you very much. Reporting on the situation on the ground in Erbil, Susanna George files for the Global Post. Thanks, Susanna.
Thank you.
As you heard there from Susanna, there's increasing talk about dividing Iraq into three parts, Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish. That idea is being pushed especially hard by Kurdish leaders. But Zuhair al-Nahar, a spokesman for Iraq's Shiite Prime Minister, Nuri al-Maliki, says that's not going to happen. And he keeps beating the drum that the country won't fall apart and saying these Sunni fighters from ISIS don't stand a chance. So saber-rattling big time and very literal, part politically motivated, but that's also ethnically fueled. John, you spent time in Iraqi Kurdistan, not to mention other parts of the country. How did you get your head around the sectarian divide when you were there?
Well, let's take the Kurdish piece first. I mean, you'll notice that the ambassador who we spoke to earlier this hour says that when the cleric, chief cleric in Shiite cleric in Iraq says Shiites must fight for the country of Iraq, that the ambassador says it's not about religion at all. But Susanna George told us there that the Shiites who abandoned their posts, once they heard Sistani saying you have to enter the battle again, they said, OK, I'll do it because it is a religious battle. The Kurds have had the best deal of all since even before Saddam Hussein. They've had an autonomous situation in the north of Iraq, and they have ethnic history in Turkey and Syria as well. They stand to do the best. It's much more in the Shiite and Sunni areas where there's going to be conflict over oil in the south and definitely over the political power that has traditionally existed around Baghdad. I've spent a lot of time in the south of Iraq, and you know, it's a very different poverty-stricken zone, even though there's lots of oil and energy in that region.
So, John, let's just take a little time now to look at these sectarian divides on the special Iraq edition of The World and the Takeaway. This Sunni-Shia divide specifically that gets so exploited and gets so much attention in these times of crisis in Iraq. I spoke with writer Azadeh Moveni. She's the author of Lipstick Jihad. Some have read that. And she's pretty good at unpacking several centuries of history. I asked her to explain where these terms, Sunni and Shia, come from, first of all.
They go back to a schism that emerged in the earliest days of Islam in the 7th century. And they represent two different factions that had disputing beliefs about who should lead the Muslim community after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. So the terms refer to two groups. Sunni comes from Ahl Sunnah, so people of the tradition. And this refers to the group that believed that Muhammad's descendants along a particular line, Abu Bakr, a caliph at the time, should succeed Muhammad.
The Shias, a caliph being a ruler, a king.
A ruler, exactly. The Shia, the term comes from a political faction, okay? So the Shiat of Ali, the party of Ali. So Ali was a son-in-law of the Prophet, and the group that came to be known as the party of Ali believed that his descendants should be leading the Islamic community. So it emerges from this power struggle.
And the bad blood we're seeing right now between, if we can generalize, between Sunni and Shia populations in Iraq, is that reproduced in other countries around the world where you have this divide?
Well, there are other countries that encompass both Shia and Sunni Muslims where there is sectarian or this kind of sect-based conflict. There are places where it is not. I mean, in Iraq, before the fall of Saddam Hussein, for example, there was a great deal of intermarriage between Shia and Sunni. You know, places like Bahrain, where, you know, has a sizable Shia population. But before the political conflict there and the opposition to the Bahraini rulers became cast in sectarian terms, there was not a conflict. People were living very peacefully along one another. So I think it's very important to bear in mind that these differences are very much, you know, in the last 50 years, magnified, instigated, you know, they fall into the political context of a lot of the conflicts in which we're seeing this divide cast.
So, like, if I'm walking down the street and I see two Muslims, one is Shia, one is Sunni, say they're both from Iraq, would I be able to tell the difference?
You wouldn't immediately know. You know, there are a couple of things. For example, there are countries like Lebanon where Shia have been historically much poorer, for example. You know, they did not receive the kind of resources, the kind of infrastructure, healthcare. You know, so in a place like Beirut, you know, at some point you might have been able to say this is a Shia villager. In more cosmopolitan, different contexts, no. In Iraq, you might not have known at all. You know, there are places where it would come up, for example. Like Shia have a very different attitude towards bioethics. So a Shia couple might go do IVF and they might, you know, beyond IVF, they might do assisted reproduction. They might have, you know, surrogacy. These are things that in the Shia world are very acceptable. You know, that Sunni couple, you might see them sitting in a cafe and never know that they're of a different sect. But privately in their homes, for example, things like that might matter.
So you've got these different interpretations of the religion over centuries, but that's taken hold. And in recent years, and it's just been the source of so much violence, it seems, in the Mideast. I mean, how do you go from, well, we don't see eye to eye on these particular kind of religious precepts, but we're going to kill each other?
Well, I think very often it comes down to very ruthless, powerful leaders, autocrats, dictators, who see the potential for stoking this kind of difference and use it to their advantage. You know, Iraq is a very complex society. For example, there's, you know, a tribal overlay over Iraq. But Saddam Hussein used sect as a way to extend his political party, his ambitions as a Ba'athist. So very often in these conflicts, it becomes part of a wider political project that makes use of sect or this kind of religious difference to take itself forward.
What happens to Sunnis and Shia when they arrive in the United States, for example? Are the terms suddenly less loaded when they arrive here?
I think they're far less politicized, certainly. There are differences in ritual. You know, the Shia are often described as the Catholics of Islam. There's a lot of attention to martyrdom and saints or imams. It's a slightly different religious culture. But that recedes, I think, in the diaspora and in places where it's not in the middle of a fraught political conflict. I think intermarriage is quite common. You know, I think both would see themselves in the diaspora as part of a wider Muslim community, but vested in that, you know, the identity of their particular sect.
That was writer Azadeh Moveni, author of Lipstick Jihad, breaking down for us where the Sunni-Shia split came from and what it all means.
It's a fascinating discussion. And, you know, if you talk to intellectuals in Iran, in Turkey, in Iraq, and in places like Egypt, they say that during Ottoman times, this was completely dormant. This became a political movement in 1979 during the Iranian Revolution, when Ayatollah Khomeini showed that you could create an identity around this sectarian notion of the descendant of the prophet and turn it into political power. And it all descends from that.
You know, on a peaceful note, John, I learned a new word today, sushi. It's a child that stems from a parent who's Sunni and another parent who is Shia. Very clever.
Oh, gosh. We're adding something new to the discussion, and that's good.
Well, one of the big sticking points between the Sunnis and Shiites is where the money has been spent over the last several years. We've pulled the data and mapped out where the international development projects in Iraq are located. You can see that at PRI.org. Earlier, John Hockenberry talked about his experience reporting in Iraqi Kurdistan, and that reminded me of a song by the New York-based string quartet, Brooklyn Rider. This is their song called Silent City. It's a collaboration with Iranian musician Kehan Kalor. The artists say the song is a testament to the disappearance of cities and civilizations, but the original artistic inspiration, if you can call it that, was the massacre of Kurds in the southern Kurdistan city of Halabja in 1988. Saddam Hussein launched what would be the largest chemical weapons attack in history against a civilian population. Here's more of Silent City, performed by Brooklyn Rider and Kehan Kalor.
That is so heartbreaking. I've been to Halabja long after that chemical attack, and so many Iraqis, whether they're in Iraq or outside, just want the noise of all of this politics to end. So that title of the song there really speaks to the heart, Marco.
I know people who have seen Brooklyn Rider and Kehan Kalor perform this live, and to take the kind of meaning of it out of Iraq, out of Kurdistan, they performed it in Santa Barbara, and I know some people who responded to the quartet afterwards and went up to them and said, this evokes New Orleans and Katrina. Mm-hmm. So it's universal. This is a special program about Iraq produced in partnership with PRI's The World and The Takeaway. I'm Marco Werman with The World.
And I'm John Hockenberry with The Takeaway. We've been talking about Iraq for the last hour, and one side effect of the unfolding crisis there is that here in the United States, we're thinking back to the original arguments for the war, and we've had to restate and rethink the arguments for what is or is not our responsibility in Iraq right now.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns.
This is a regime with a very long history now of deception and deceit. And we don't need to waste the world's time waiting around to let them...
In a free Iraq, there will be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors. No more poison factories. No more executions of dissidents. No more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near.
Wow, that takes me back. George W. Bush and members of his administration making the case for war before the U.S.-led invasion in 2003 into Iraq. You know, you hear those voices promising a great future for Iraq, and then you see what's happening now. It's such a terrible contrast. Today, President Obama talked about Iraq, taking some small steps to help the Iraqi government battle the Sunni insurgents that are threatening the country. But he also acknowledged the political tensions here at home.
Recent days have reminded us of the deep scars left by America's war in Iraq. Alongside the loss of nearly 4,500 American patriots, many veterans carry the wounds of that war and will for the rest of their lives. Here at home, Iraq sparked vigorous debates and intense emotions in the past, and we've seen some of those debates resurface.
It's extraordinary. You know, there's a question, an unanswerable question I've been thinking about all week. Would it be better to have someone in the White House who voted for the war originally or who voted against the war originally? Of course, Barack Obama voted against the war. Who would have more of a stake, more of a sense of gut in the battle for what to do now? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that anyone knows the answer to that. But now, far from 9/11 and the original arguments for invading Iraq in 2003, the debate is very, very different. Takeaway Washington, D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick. Where does the political discourse stand right now that the president has spoken, has decided some things, but so much yet to be decided? Todd?
That's true, John. And hi, Marco. And really what the president is trying to do here in his statement today is emphasize a political solution in Iraq. It remains to be seen whether that will be possible. Here's what the president said we are going to do. First, increasing surveillance above Iraq. Senior administration officials now saying they have round-the-clock capability with manned and unmanned aircraft to monitor the situation with ISIS on the ground. Secondarily, a group of up to 300 U.S. advisors, special forces, into Iraq. Senior administration officials saying today that those will be concentrated mostly in Baghdad at the senior headquarter level, but that some U.S. military advisors will be going out possibly to headquarters and other places in Iraq to assess the Iraqi military's capabilities right now to defend themselves against ISIS insurgents and other elements in Iraq and what they need in order to be able to join the fight. Now, of course, that brings other questions, and I know you're already thinking, what about the possibility of U.S. airstrikes? The president did not rule airstrikes out. There are lots of Navy and other assets that have moved into the region. Of course, as we know, aircraft carriers, amphibious assault ships, and those could be used. I want to point out one other thing that was not ruled out by senior administrations when officials, John, when specifically asked about this. Asked, would the potential of U.S. airstrikes limit the United States to the territory of Iraq? They did not rule out chasing ISIS and other elements into other countries, including Syria.
Oh, that's interesting. Also, John Kerry, Secretary of State, will be going to Iraq possibly to give Nouri al-Maliki some political cover as there's some decision possibly made to try to see if there's a leadership transition that's even possible. There are religious leaders in Iraq right now discussing a possible transition. Whether the U.S. is involved in that, we don't know. I don't want to sound completely annoying here, Todd, but it would seem that the training that these 300 special forces are going to do might also include, hey, folks, when ISIS starts shooting, please don't run.
Well, there is a lot of pessimism, John, which you're alluding to about the capabilities and will to fight on the part of of Iraqi security forces. And a lot of this, according to the White House, goes right back to the politics in Baghdad. One of the reasons why they're stressing the importance of some semblance of unity between the sectarian parties in Baghdad is to say to them, if you guys cannot pull together some kind of coalition, either post-Maliki or with Maliki, a government that can function, there is no hope of Baghdad being able to direct a military response out in the field. The army simply will not respond to Baghdad if there's not unified politics. So that's the political end, as the fight is joined again in Iraq, that the American advisors and American political advisors are going for here.
Finally, Todd, in the political unity in Washington, is there something that needs to happen, a resolution, a bipartisan resolution that's going to indicate some solidarity to Nouri al-Maliki and the people in Baghdad?
Probably not, John. The president apparently telling congressional leaders yesterday that he does not feel that he needs additional congressional authorization for anything that is in the realm of possibility for him here. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader, says she agrees with that, although she said specifically today, be extremely careful before sending special forces into Iraq. She said that's a number that can grow, sort of a brushback for the president there.
Takeaway Washington, D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
Marco?
Yeah, you know, John, I don't want to say slippery slope, but we've heard today Obama say the U.S. would airstrike targets if assessed to be dangerous. He also, as Todd just pointed out, these advisors going in would assess the capabilities of the Iraqi army, and suddenly slippery slope kind of feels appropriate.
Well, you know, 11 years of slippery slope. I mean, this is really a long, long journey that we've been on, and this may be the decisive end game here. Where it leads, I don't know.
John Hockenberry with the Takeaway. That brings us to the end of this special edition of The World in Partnership with you guys down there in New York at The Takeaway. Before we wrap up, though, we've got this non-Iraq news of the death of the great jazz pianist Horace Silver, but there actually is a connection. Silver sucked up a lot of sounds from around the globe. He wrote the Cape Verdean blues. He wrote the Tokyo blues. So today, let's go out with Horace Silver's evocative Baghdad Blues. You've been listening to a special hour all about Iraq from PRI's The World in partnership with The Takeaway. John, great doing the show with you.
It's so great listening to The World. You never know. You always know you'll hear something new and great. Thanks, Marco. Great to be here. This is WNYC in New York, signing off.
And I'm Marco Werman in Boston, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. Thank you for tuning in.